The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. You're with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower. And I'm not joined by my intrepid Dr. Watson, Dr. Robert Brennan. He is still missing in action somewhere in Europe, having a good time. He did send an email this week, so he's still alive. He's still fighting the good fight, and you can see him on Substack, Robert Against the Machine. But he has not volunteering for work. So, and we also had an American whistleblower who was going to do today's show, and unfortunately, something's happened for them. But I've got something which I think will be even better. I'm going to talk about my own book, and which is coming out in early November in Penguin Random House, and it is called The Nature of Honor. And it goes through my life. While that may seem like a sort of fairly, egoistic thing to do, I think you'd enjoy it, and in the sense that it talks a lot about failure, striving for various successes, growing up in the late 60s, early 70s, and going to the UK, and the various good and bad things that happened to me there, and coming back to Australia and trying to put my values into action in the Australian Defence Force, and the successes or otherwise that I had of that. So it's got quite an interesting geopolitical subplot, starting in the 70s, and perhaps some of the best things about the Western world, and then going on to where we are today, and looking at whether we've gone backwards or forwards, or whether where we are at, with a lot of sort of funny, tragic personal anecdotes along the way. So I think I think it's enjoyable. I hope it is anyway, as good as any other guest that we can have on. If people about my age, I'll be 60 in December after the book comes out, will remember the show and the book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It was a good book. It was an okay TV show or movie. The concepts were quite hard, I think, to put on screen without a lot of money. Like a lot of these books, I think Terry Pratchett as well, they're great books, they're great radio shows, but your imagination is often more powerful than a movie can make. I remember seeing that when I was a kid growing up, and I was very scared of vampires, and people would tell me about a vampire movie, and I'd be so scared of it. And eventually I'd see the story, and then I'd see the movie that I'd been told about, and it wouldn't be nearly as scary as how I imagined it. And the human imagination, especially for people, listeners of this show, is strong. And I believe that with The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I was at boarding school at the time. It was about 1980, I think, 1981 maybe. And I used to think about the world and wanted to get out of school. People my age will know that, but even younger people should be able to get their head around that same sort of concept, wanting to get out of school, wanting to see New York and London and the places we'd only dreamed about it. And The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on the radio show, which was on the ABC, I found it by accident, and I just loved it. I used to listen to it every week, and it was funny, it was thought-provoking, and I'd sit there, and it had I remember at the end, it was quite moving when the heroes who have totally failed in their mission and but they are sitting back down in Earth, and they have Louis Armstrong playing. It's a Wonderful World, and I remember thinking, what a great show. So the devil's in the detail. I'm not going to rush through the life story. I am going to try to tell a good story, and actually there'll be details on this, quite a few details on this sort of radio version of my story, which won't make the book because we just simply don't have time. So sit back and listen to some funny stories. This version, the last time I did this, we got up to the early 60s, and my father, his experience with thalidomide, getting the credit for being the first person to really cotton on that this drug that was just a morning sickness drug, a sort of Panadol-type drug, which didn't affect the mother in any particularly bad way, could have terrible effects on the developing fetus. And it was taken off the shelves around the world. He was a 30-year-old doctor. I wasn't even born, but I was about to be born. That was like 1961. We were living in Blakehurst. For those of you who know, in Sydney, it was in the south of Sydney, near the Shire, not quite the Shire, and not quite the inner west, and not quite the eastern suburbs. It's sort of, and we were on the Georges River, in a nice house with a decent garden. And I remember the cicadas, the sound of the cicadas when I was young, and us trying to capture cicadas and have a collection of them, black princes and things like that. Silkworms were all the rage. I don't know what we were going to do. We were going to make things out of the silk or sell the silk or all these kind of crazy plans that that young kids have to get rich. It was one of the many, many plans I had. The lunar landing happened when I was in preschool. I was going to Trinity Grammar and had a little tie, and I was about six. I remember the teacher showing us the photos. We tried to watch it on TV, I think, and just see the spacecraft going through the sky. I was too young. I couldn't really work out what was happening on the TV, and I couldn't see the thing in the sky. I was colorblind. I didn't realize at the time. So, colored stars or colored satellites, I couldn't see them. But I remember those days. And when I was about seven, I went off to boarding school, which I didn't particularly like. But it was an experience. Say that I was away from the TV. My brother and I spent all our time watching American TV shows, Gilligan's Island, which we loved, Hogan's Heroes, which was probably our absolute favorite, and I Dream of Jeannie. All of these things that we grew up on. And sometimes in those days, the televisions used to have tubes. There was no such thing as a flat screen. It was about as big as a refrigerator, and the tubes in the back would often blow. We'd berate our mother to go to the TV repair shop. You had to take the whole thing in or to get the guy to come out, like fixing a fridge. Because, you know, a couple of days without a TV was very hard for us. And at boarding school, it seemed pretty grim. I didn't really enjoy it. No TV, and we had to sleep in little beds. We had to make our own beds and had to do hospital corners, and the matron used to inspect them. We were allowed some comforts. We had our own blankets, and we were allowed to take our teddy bears, and I had this old teddy bear and sort of German teddy bear with its fur all ruffled, which I'd had since I was a baby, it had there were four children, and my mother was a doctor and my father was a doctor, and they were working pretty hard. But so we had our Karatani nannies, if those of you, they were sort of New Zealanders, probably teenagers, early 20s, would come over and look after us. And one of them knitted an outfit for my teddy bear, but like a top and a bottom. But because it shrunk and it looked like the teddy bear was wearing a bikini. So I remember one of the first fights I got into at boarding school was over my teddy bear looking like it was wearing a bikini. So we had a bit of a punch up over that. And but that was what boarding school was like. You had teddy bears, and but you still had to make your bed and you'd occasionally have a bit of a punch up over something. But we'd also have books read to us. I remember we're having Rudyard Kipling's Rikki Tikki Tavi, the story of the mongoose that fought the cobra and saved the Indian family, which I thought was fantastic. And we heard G-rated versions of the Greek myths, Ulysses out there fighting cyclopses. And I used to sit on the edge of the bed or on the floor, I think, in our dressing gowns. We had those old dressing gowns in the days and those old style pajamas. And we'd sit there on the veranda listening to this great teacher. There were some great teachers who would read us stories of adventure and around the world, and it certainly got my imagination. And luckily, I did through one term of boarding school, which I found very hard, and they'd bought me all of these clothes I was going to grow into. I had these shoes like clown shoes. They were way too big. I don't think I ever grew into them. I didn't have particularly big feet, but that was that was sort of all part of the whole boarding school experience. But then in the second term, the winter term, the Australian winter term, Dad had been given an award for his work on thalidomide. This is about 10 years after the fact, when it took a while for him to get the credit, and he had a very good investigative journalist team in the Sunday Times in London before it was a Murdoch paper, and they pushed his case, and they got compensation for the victims of thalidomide. Mainly the journalists did that, and they also exposed what a disaster it was, in that the drug had never been properly tested. There was no drugs were really properly tested. They found interesting chemical compounds, and they gave them to volunteers who were down on their luck and needed $50 or probably $10. And they would give them these drugs and say, what does that make you feel? And I think people said it was a sedative. They thought it made them relax them a little bit. It was obviously some sort of a feel-good tablet. And one of the people, heaven forbid, must have been pregnant, one of the test group, volunteer test group, said, oh, look, it cured my morning sickness. And there you go, they had a morning sickness drug. And it was by prescription, but because they were all about making profits and prescription limited their profits, the drug company sort of marketing team were pushing to have it be made over the counter. Imagine how many more people would have been affected. There were many, many thousands around the world as it was, but there'd be tens of thousands had it eventually become an over-the-counter. So it was a bit of a scandal. And this has analogies to sort of big pharma today, when you think about how little regulation really goes in, and how much marketing is at play when they're putting new pharmacy medications on the shelves, and marketing and economics are what really runs the day, rather than efficacy or safety. That will ring true to many of the TNT listeners, but that was in the 1960s, and I don't think things have gotten any better. One of the things that has probably changed is that I don't know that Dad would have survived that calling out a big pharmacy company in those days was possible. They admitted that another German scientist backed him up, and they admitted their faults. But you can imagine, we don't have to imagine, we've seen what's happened in those who want to take the big pharma on today. And you will end up vilified, destroyed, and maybe even dead. Who knows? Today they play for keeps, and it's a very dangerous job to sort of say something is an over-the-counter drug or some other medication is dangerous. You know, you take your life in your own hands. But he got credit for it, and so we got a trip to Paris, and luckily, to their great credit, even though they, my parents growing up in the Depression, and they really valued education above everything. Education was the way out of the suburbs, and it was the way to get ahead. And both my mother and my father were the first people in their families to get to any university, let alone medical school. They both got scholarships, and they really wanted to become professionals. And they were in that sweet spot for professionals, where just outside social circles, not coming from money, smart and determined. And so all they wanted to do was to sort of become well-to-do, I guess. And even though they loved education and they sent us to private schools, we would have been the first people in our families to go to private schools, in extended families. Our grandparents lived in fairly modest houses and nothing like what we lived in. And so is that sort of first generation wealth sort of thing that happens to a lot of professionals in Australia. Our ancestors were immigrants. And as I talked about in the first episode, my original Australian ancestors were all convicts who married each other and had children. And those children married people who had both parents convicts as well. So it was a pure convict line. We'd come from humble beginnings, criminal beginnings, and they didn't steal loaves of bread either. Most of them seemed to be professional criminals or people who just got sick of everything and went the whole hog, and second or third offences and relatively major offences in those days. So we went off to Paris, and we got this Air France flight together. We weren't in first class, but it was very exciting for my brother and I. I was 7, he was 10. And they had one of the first things we remember, and it's funny, and listeners will have similar experiences. When you travel as a child, you see things very differently to the adults. And I remember thinking how glamorous the Air France hostesses were. They were called hostesses then, flight attendants. And they came down the aisles handing out these incredible French sweets, bonbons. And of course, my brother and I just chucked our little grubby hands in the whole bag, took out as many as we could, stuffed our faces with these bonbons. Didn't do our teeth any good. We both had a lot of fillings for young kids. We chewed up these quite hard, sugary sweets and sat back and enjoyed the flight. It was pretty funny in those days. You could still smoke on flights. And I remember part of my European experience was the smells. And I remember the smell of the Gaulois and when we got to Paris as well. But the perfume of the hostesses as they walked past, and the smell of the sort of TV dinners that you got on the plane, everything, the smells, and particularly when we landed in Bangkok. You had two stopovers in those days, and we landed in Bangkok, and they opened the cabin door. It was night. I don't know what time at night it was. It seemed very late, probably about 10 o'clock at night. And you could, the heat came in the door of the plane, and you could smell 1,000 smells, what I thought anyway, herbs, spices, aviation fuel, of course, and the heat of the Bangkok night. the sounds, you could just feel it was, this was different. This was a different world. This was nothing like Sydney. Even though Sydney had heat and humidity, this was different. I felt like in a different place. We got off the plane and we got into the terminal, which was very rudimentary in those days. But it was, you could, there were smells everywhere. There was the cooking of the sort of Southeast Asian food, which we'd never really seen. In those days, Australia was very white bread, especially in Blakehurst, probably everywhere. Kentucky Fried Chicken was about as exotic as you got. We sometimes went there as a family. It's funny to think of a family of two doctors as parents taking us to Kentucky Fried Chicken, but they, you know, we thought it was great. You know, we'd stick the drumsticks in the in that potato, mashed potato, whatever it is, and we never tasted anything quite so exotic. But then most dinners were chops, three cutlets, and peas cutlets and a potato, and it was the same thing every night. We didn't complain, and mint jelly. But so Kentucky Fried Chicken was exotic, and when we got to Bangkok, we couldn't quite believe the noodles and the smells. But what attracted us most, that they had these funny little duty-free stores, and they didn't have any electronics or anything like that. Well, what they did have was stuffed cobras looking very fierce and with marbles in their eyes, and they're probably not allowed to do it now, but these cobras ride up on their haunches ready to strike. And they also had taxidermy mongoose, and you could buy a sort of Ricky Tikki Tavi about a couple of feet high of this sort of king cobra fighting the mongoose, which my brother and I were fascinated. We wanted Dad to buy one for us, which he politely declined, but we thought a stuffed snake and a stuffed mongoose in battle with their teeth bearing was the height of fashion. We wanted that to display that in our house. But what he did let us buy were snakeskin belts, which we thought were fantastic. So we got these snakeskin belts, which has got a bit of humor for me now, because I've now got a pair of snakeskin boots. I'm going to have to go for a break here. So I had a pair of snakeskin boots now, which reminds me of my snakeskin belt. In those days, we had leather jackets. Suede jackets, like Easy Rider. We weren't allowed to see Easy Rider, so we had our suede jackets on with the tassels. So we were in Bangkok Airport, and we got back on the plane, and now we're going to have to go for a break. You're listening to McBride and Brennan. It's David McBride talking about my upcoming book, about my life, and I'll see you in 2 minutes. Let's go to a break.
For Voye Morich on TNT Radio.
There is some interesting Skynet news. Pentagon to develop drone swarms for war with China. Boy, oh boy, echoes of Terminator 2. The DoD is developing the ability to launch thousands of drones at a time for use in a future war with China. I don't know about you, but my running hypothesis is that, yeah, there probably will be a war with China, and then in the aftermath, these drone swarm technologies, Skynet basically, will be used to manage us. Just think about the global war on terror and how all of those technologies used in Iraq and Afghanistan have now come home to roost. A lot of those tanks and equipment, you know, they're being used by, given to local police forces across the United States, and we're now having a domestic war on terror.
For Voye Morich on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
How often should you wash your hands?
Maybe around 9 times a day.
4? Like 20?
Maybe twice a day.
Whenever they feel dirty.
When should you wash your hands?
After you touch some raw meat.
And before starting to eat.
At the beginning, I wash my hands before preparing food.
How would you rate your knowledge of food safety?
Probably like an 8 out of 10.
6 or 7.
7.5. Like, I know the basics, but I'm not necessarily like an expert in it by any means.
Food safety, it's in your hands.
You're with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower. I'm not joined by Dr. Robert Brennan, He's away, malingering somewhere in some exotic location. Hopefully he's at least listening. Robert, come back and help me out. But today I'm having fun without you anyway. And I'm telling, giving a pricey, some of the chapters in my book, which is going to come out in about a month, talking about the ups and downs of my rather humorous life. Some of it geopolitics and some of it just life as a, like growing up in Australia in the 60s and 70s, and that's where we're at the moment. I'm in Bangkok with my family and we're on the way to Paris. My first overseas trip anywhere, and it's a pretty good way to start. We take off from Bangkok, and on that longest leg of the trip, they have movies. In those days, for younger people, find this fairly amusing, but they actually had movie screens and rather than little personal televisions. And at the front of each section of the plane, they pull down a screen, a slide screen, and there would be a film shown, movie shown, a different movie shown, and pretty much in every section of the plane. I think there's about three or four sections. And so if you didn't like the movie that you had in your section, you could, and if there were spare seats, and in those days they were, again, nostalgia. In those days the planes weren't full like they are now. And you could often find three seats in a row if you're really, really tired and need to lie down. And so we had this movie, Paint Your Wagon, which was a comedy with Lee Marvin. I liked Lee Marvin, but we'd seen it before. And my dad loved comedies. He was very very easy to make laugh. His father, my grandfather, who was a First World War veteran I've talked about before, they had very simple tastes. He loved Charlie Chaplin, which I couldn't understand that it was funny, but he thought it was funny. He also loved wrestling, and he loved the Australian wrestling. This is my grandfather, Pop. And I could possibly see why now. He'd been a World War I veteran. He'd been out there as a stretcher bearer picking up dead and dying in no man's land in Western France, in the mud and the blood and the rain. And, people, I think one of the most awful things I learned when I was much older was that a lot of people, where the Australians were in Patchendale, or Ypres, as they call it, were drowned in the mud, and absolutely drowned in the mud. In not shot, not hit, killed by artillery, but drowned in the mud, and people couldn't do much about it. And that was it was obviously pretty horrific. But he never talked about it. He was only ever an optimistic guy, and he loved the wrestling. He used to watch the Australian wrestling on a Saturday morning, and very simple tastes. And he'd Mario Milano and Killer Kowalski. And some people, listeners might remember that, Abdul the Butcher. All very innocent stuff. My grandfather loved that. But I had different sort of tastes, and I wanted to watch a war movie, and I'd saw through the curtain. I used to close the curtain so the movie in front of you in the plane didn't disturb you. And my parents looked around at one point and found that the 7-year-old had disappeared, and I had snuck through the curtain, and I'd gone into the next section of the plane, because what I saw in the gap looked far more interesting to me. And it was a war movie, Patton, an Oscar-winning movie about General George Patton, this American general who most people will have heard of him, but who was notorious in some ways. He got sacked a few times for slapping soldiers, for being cowards, and he also seemed to have really taken the fight to the German army, the Nazis in the Second World War, and pushed through with tremendous odds and in many ways helped shorten the war. But so it's quite a good story, and it's done in a relatively grown-up way, not in a hero-worshipping way, and it deals with his good and bad points, why he was probably a good leader, and why he was also a very bad politician, and you followed it through, and I was fascinated. Even though I was only seven, I watched this movie, and I was fascinated by the war, by leadership, sacrifice, and my parents were quite bemused by this. That a 7 year old, and they were both doctors, and they didn't. There was some sort of there was some sort of military connection, even though my grandfather had been in the First World War. He was just a stretcher bearer, and he was, you know, we didn't come from any sort of heroic military background at all. And so they were quite bemused that I thought Patton was what it was all about. And I've heard it said, I think this comes from the Catholic religion, show me the boy at seven and I'll show you the man. Hence they're wanting to indoctrinate people when they're very young. And yes, and that's pretty much, it's funny that what I wanted to be when I was seven, a soldier, is what I eventually became. And even though in the meantime, I chopped and changed about careers. We eventually landed in Bahrain, which was the second stop. And it was, again, I don't know that my memory might be playing tricks for me, but it was very rudimentary in Bahrain in those days. It was just a fuel stop, and you really knew you were in the desert. It was hot again. It must have been dawn, I guess, or early hours of the morning, and because it was dark from my memory, and we had to get off the plane again. And this may be my memory playing tricks with me, but it seemed to be you could see camels from the airport. Probably, it's possibly true, but my eyes were popping out of my head because I certainly had not seen anything like that. And we hadn't even landed in Paris, and I was already, my mind was being blown with the smells and tastes of Bangkok, and now the sort of hot heat of the deserts of the world. And people certainly wearing Arab dress, which I'd never seen, people in veils and keeping to themselves, and even the men in flowing robes. So it was just very, very extraordinary. And things were, the world, this was before globalization, the world was different. You know, Bahrain was a very different place to Sydney or London, and Bangkok was as well. And there was foreign writing. Everything wasn't in English. It was a lot more foreign language spoken. French was as big a language as English, and things were quite different. Eventually, we landed in Paris, and things were different again. We got out at Charles de Gaulle Airport, which was this modern, in the 70s, very modern. It was all sort of space age looking. And my brother and I, again, seeing the world from a 7 year old's perspective, a 10 year old, we just saw, we didn't see the big things. We saw everything as an opportunity to have fun. And so those, escalators, we would run up the down escalator to see who could, you know, get to the top first. We would run along those conveyor belts. We would jump up onto the ones that had the baggage. Lucky we didn't get badly injured. The ones that had the baggage carousels. Everything was, you can see why they sent us to boarding school. Every place we went was an opportunity to carry out pranks or I can only think of what my parents felt traveling with us. They had two teenage or preteen girls, and international travel was quite a long haul thing in those days anyway, and to have a 7-year-old, hyperactive 7-year-old and 10-year-old boy just charging around the airport, running off and doing whatever they felt like they wanted to do, and squirting water at each other. That was another good trick. It must have been very, very hard for them. But anyway, we went into Paris and we stayed at this hotel, which had been a sort of had seen better days. It was on the left bank. It was called the Lutèce. I think it's now since been revived because it's quite a glamorous looking. I think it's probably the turn of the 20th century. It's Art Nouveau, I think, and it's quite a nice sort of place. By then, it was a bit tired. Although still quite a good hotel, and it smelled. I remember it smelled. You remember the smells again. It smelled of brown sugar for some reason, and we would enjoy sitting there and playing pranks on the waiters, racing in the elevators, and generally just having our eyes popping out. Paris was an incredible. It seemed like an incredible, beautiful city in those days. It was before mass tourism. It was before the refugees. Everything from my memory was very clean. The parks, public parks, were really quite amazing. They had remote control sailing boats. Coming from Australia, we'd never seen it. They're quite commonplace now, of course. But in 1971, we'd never seen anything like it. And these French kids seemed very spoiled to us. They had remote control boats and even just beautiful model sailboats. That looked like exact replicas ocean going yachts, and they worked. And so if you set them up and put them on the pond in one of these beautiful French parks, the light breeze would take them over to the other side as if they were sailing across the Atlantic. And my brother and I were just gobsmacked. This was sort of a paradise for little boys. They also had, you could rent these pedal carts, which you'd pedal around as fast as you can. Of course, everything was a race. My brother and I would get in the pedal carts and we'd race each other around the park, probably knocking over French people trying to have a nice time. I don't know what they thought of these two rough Australians who had their strong accents and grubby knees, but we were just charging around thinking it was a terrific place. Then we had the ceremony at the Palace of Versailles, and we didn't really appreciate it at the time, but those of you know, it's one of the most amazing historical buildings in the world, built by Louis the 14th, I think, and one of these sort of French kings for whom lavish decoration and was completely there was no limit to what he would do and what he spent. And one of these, of course, before the revolution, one of the reasons probably had the revolution, but there's a particular room in the palace called the Hall of Mirrors, which is famous for those history buffs will know. The Hall of Mirrors was where they signed the I think the Treaty of Versailles, where all the delegates from the different nations worked out the ill-fated Treaty of Versailles, which many people believe was one of the reasons we had a Second World War, was that it was so harsh on the German people and so short-sighted. It meant that the Germans were an angry nation looking to kind of get revenge, and Hitler gave them that an avenue for that anger, I guess. So that the Palace of Versailles and the Hall of Mirrors have been, you know, quite historical. So this is where we had the award. Dad got the award. It was the equivalent of a Nobel Prize, I guess. It doesn't exist anymore, but the French, being French, wanted to have their own Nobel Prize, and they gave Dad this award, and all the speeches were in French. The president of France was there, Pompidou, and it was an amazing ceremony. But again, my brother and I were more concerned with the shiny shoes. We'd never seen such shiny shoes, and we posed for photos. The TV people were there, and then we went back to the hotel to cause some more mayhem. And I will get back to the story in just a minute, where we get arrested and for the first time, and we go on to London. So you're listening to McBride and Brennan. I'm talking about my upcoming book about my childhood and how I got to where I am today, good and bad. And I'm going to take a 2-minute break and come back after the break and hear about me getting arrested age 7. See you in 2 minutes.
We believe in patriotism. We believe in our country. For 100 years, veterans have been impacting our nation through the American Legion. Learn more at legion.org/we believe.
You're listening to McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower, facing trial on five counts of espionage or breaching national security. I don't have Dr. Robert Brennan here today, but I'm talking about my upcoming book, which goes right back to the beginning, my values, what I thought was what I thought mattered in life. And I'm now dealing with I'm dealing with the early days, I guess, and what I saw and what I thought. And hopefully those of you of my age are having a nice trip down memory lane about your own early experiences, and those younger will be hearing about a world which in many ways doesn't really exist anymore. So we're in Paris. My father got this award, and my brother and I are causing havoc wherever we go. We do like Paris. In those days, we were car mad, and we loved, we had model cars. I don't know whether people still make model cars, but they in those days it was a big thing. Everything model. We had a model of the lunar landing, Airfix. I loved Airfix, Airfix planes, and we used to go to a place in Sydney. I think it still exists. I'm not sure, but it's quite good. It's called Hobby Go, and we would buy Airfix planes. We would buy little soldiers. I've forgotten the brand. These little soldiers, and you could get whole armies. You had the British 8th Army from the Second World War, and you had the German Africa Corps, and you could set it up. If you were very handy, you could make a little a battle scene. You had Normandy landing sort of troops, and you had broken down farmhouses, and you could Hasbro, I think maybe that comes from memory. If anyone wants to send me a message about the Hasbro, whether you were a military tragic like me and you had all those little models, scale models. I think there might have been 1 in 20th, is that right? 1 in 12 of the military, and you recreated these battles. I was never very particularly handy, and the results of my making these FX models and probably never looked as good as they did in the brochures on the box, but that's all right. You know, I had a Spitfire, built a Spitfire, and my father showed it to one of his friends who hadn't been a Spitfire pilot, but he'd been a Hurricane pilot, you know, in the Second World War. He's a bit older than my father, and he'd gone to be in the RAF. I don't think he was very impressed with my Spitfire. It wasn't made very well. I was pretty young, and as I said, not particularly neat with my painting. He had to buy all the right colours, and it showed you had to put the camouflage green and brown, put the stickers on there, and to make it look, put the numbers on there, the stickers on there. And you'd even have little tiny ones to put how many German kills, and you would proudly display it. There were older boys that lived up the street from us, who were much better at, a bit older, and they were much better at making the models. And I think they used to sell them to us because they'd make them so well. And we were not, we were a bit younger and not very good, that they realized, like a lot of kids, this was a good way to make a buck. And they'd make they'd sell, oh, you know, you got $5 if you really like it, that Spitfire or that that Lunar module, you can buy it. That was probably a good little money-making thing for us. So we would get our parents to pay $5 or whatever to get a decent-looking model. But anyway, the Spitfire, the real Spitfire pilot is a gentleman called Gordon Mackay. He was quite old school. He had kind of a English accent. He'd grown up in the country, and he'd gone to England to join the RAF in the, I don't know if it was the Battle of Britain, but maybe after that, and he'd flown in Hurricanes. And again, it was interesting to see this man who had actually been been in war. He never wanted to talk about it. Even then, when I showed him my model, it was, and another man that had, a friend of Dad's who was a doctor who must have gone to the war. He was a New Zealander and gone with the New Zealand forces at a young age because he wasn't much older than Dad, and yet he'd been in the war, and Dad was just too young, and he'd been in the Monte Cassino and the Italian campaign, which I knew about even as a kid, and I knew it was, I thought it was very heroic, but he wouldn't talk about it either because he'd, now I know why. There were huge losses of New Zealanders, and the Germans fought this very bitter rear guard action in the bricks of the ruined monastery, which has since been rebuilt. And many New Zealanders, the generals wanted them to push on, and they had to take this position, and they did take it, but it was at an awful loss of life. And so I, even though I idolised the soldiers, it was interesting that the real soldiers that I met as a kid who'd been in the Second World War, like this Hurricane pilot and like this New Zealander who was now a doctor but had just been a private soldier, I think, in those days, they did not want to talk about it. Another one of Dad's friends was a gunner on a Lancaster bomber, Arnott, Biscuits Arnott, they called him. They called him Uncle, but he wasn't really an uncle. But one of those, in those days, if someone was a very close friend of your parents, you pretended they were uncles. And he'd been a gunner. So, and since I've read about the history of the Second World War and the bombings of Germany and what it was really like and how many people just never came back, you know, not just sometimes on their very first flight. Coming straight out of flight school, age 19 or 20, and getting on a bomber to go to Berlin, and not even making it halfway there before they got shot down or blew up or something. And so pretty needless to say, people who'd really seen the real thing did not want to talk about it, not with a kid, and they knew that I had very rose-coloured glasses. But it all looked very glamorous to me then. And we went to London after that, and it was my first experience of the Household Cavalry, which I saw ride past our hotel, which was near Hyde Park. And the shiny breastplates and the black horses and their plumes. It was interesting because I didn't think too much of it, except it was a very beautiful amazing experience. But it was I would end up joining the Blues and Royals 20 years later. A lot happened between there and then. I would come back. I was about to go back to Australia, but then I would go back eventually to Oxford University and eventually join that Blues and Royals, that regiment I saw as a kid with fairly wide eyes. So we came back to Australia, and I was back at boarding school, and we used to watch war movies at night. And we used to watch all Saturday nights. It was about the only night when we got to really let our hair down. We get to watch The Guns of Navarone. People, again, my age will remember movies like that. They had to censor some of the movies where there was any sex in them. It was the old days where they had an old projector. They actually, the kids had to run it. One of the very responsible sort of 12-year-olds used to have to, and they must have had two projectors, I guess, so they could, I'm not sure if they had a break in the film. I can't remember, but the films would come in two sort of large packages about as big as a crate of wine or something, and they would put one big spool on it, would go around and around and around and around. When the halfway through the movie, they'd have to take it off and put another one on, which would go around and around. And often, of course, there'd be a break. Sometimes the film would burn because the projector was quite hot, which all the kids sitting down there and the audience in the hall would be screaming. It wasn't very conducive to showing movies, but at the time we didn't care because our imaginations were so strong and we loved watching these movies. And the highlight, I don't know if it was the highlight each week, but the headmaster on a Friday assembly would come out, and he was a guy we were all a bit scared of. In those days, you could hit boys, and if you were naughty, you wouldn't get the cane because we were only quite small, but you get something called the sand shoe, which was like a sort of Dunlop volley, which the headmaster would bend you over this particular chair in his study, and he'd whack you six of the best. You get six of the Dunlop volley on your backside. Seems quite laughable now. And you'd probably get arrested for doing it today, but that was what happened. And this headmaster that used to do that, he would bring out the book of remembrance, and he'd have a white glove on, and the book was normally kept in a glass case, and he'd turn the pages of this book one page a week, and on the book wasn't a particularly thick book, but it had in gold lettering, it had the name of someone who had died, someone who'd been to our school and died in one of the wars, sacrificed his life for his country. And I remember we'd have to have a moment's silence thinking about it, but that was what we grew up with, thinking about sacrifice and the fact that the privilege that we had, which was undoubted, came from people like us, only a few years older than us, that had actually given their lives for their country. And so that was a sort of quite a good mentoring and quite a good lesson. We are going to have to wind up now. Next time we will deal with the late 70s and senior school, and we will deal with Oxford University after that. I hope you've enjoyed it, and soon the book will be out, and I hope you all read it. But again, thank you so much for listening to me. I hope it hasn't been too self-indulgent. I hope it's giving you some good memories, and thank you for listening to McBride and Brennan, and we will be back next week, same time. And thank you to all the TNT listeners, and we will see you again. I'm Major David McBride, and you've been listening to McBride and Brennan on TNT. Thank you so much.